violent crime in the United States? In the 1950s and 1960s, virtually all of the homicides in the United States were solved within a year of the time they had been committed. That was because most of the approximately 10,000 murders committed during any one year fell into the category of murders perpetrated by someone known to the victim, by a spouse, another relative, a neighbor, or a coworker. Statistically speaking, very few had been done by a stranger or were, for other reasons, unsolvable. By the 1970s, however, the earlier situation had changed drastically. Now, of the approximately 20,000 murders committed annually in the United States, about 5,000 a year were going unsolved, about 25 to 30%. It was this fraction of the murders that Pierce Brooks hoped to address with his VICAP system. In the intervening 20 years since he had initially formulated the idea, Pierce had broadened it considerably. He wanted the system to be countrywide, not just in California, and he wanted all police departments to be able to feed in data and to use the data that was stored in the system to evaluate their own unsolved crimes. Learning of the National Institute of Justice grant to Brooks, I got in touch with him and invited him to be on the board of advisors of our Criminal Personality Research Project and to visit us at Quantico. When he saw what we were doing, he invited me and my immediate superior to join his own task force, which was operating from the good offices of Professor Doug Moore and the Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas, one of the nation's academic centers for the study of law enforcement. I never saw anyone milk a federal grant the way Pierce Brooks did. Any person knowledgeable about the ways of government would have asked Justice for a couple of $1 million to study the feasibility of a nationwide computer system. Brooks had asked for, and received, around $35,000, and he shepherded every penny of the public's money. He had assembled a stellar board of experts in homicide and other relevant fields. To attend a conference in Texas, we were asked to book our air tickets months in advance and to take super savers to keep the costs down. At Sam Houston State, we stayed in dormitories, and when it came time for a meal, Brooks had buses to ferry us to fast food restaurants. No lavish expenditures here. While I admired his husbanding of the public's money, I felt that Brooks's initial plan for VICAP would shortly become unworkable, however. His idea was to have the national headquarters for VICAP in a room or two at the Lakewood Police Department. There would be 10 or 15 terminals around the country, only in the largest localities, which meant that each terminal would have to service 2 or 3 states. To actually run the system, he'd have to apply for federal grants each year. That was when he planned to add several goose eggs to the amount he'd requested for the initial study. After he and I had gotten to know one another, I leveled with Pierce and advised him on my view of the realities of government and grants and the like. The federal government being what it was, I said, even though he might obtain a large grant in 1982, there was the likelihood that if the administration changed in 1984, a new administration would not renew the grant, and that the project would die due to lack of funds. However, if the program was part of an already existing government agency, the refunding of it could become a part of the permanent appropriation for that agency, which would mean it was much less likely to be dropped at the time of an administrative change. Moreover, I argued, if we put the VICAP program under a federal agency, there would be offices and personnel already in place, telecommunications on site, possibly even a computer system with excess capacity already installed, and the new money could be better used. One could put such a program under the auspices of the Post Office or the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, but the most logical home for it was the FBI. Even though a lot of local police departments resented the FBI, remember the one-way street? It was clear that the FBI was the correct setting for the VICAP program, especially in conjunction with the NCAVC, whose establishment we were concurrently exploring. Brooks had to agree with the logic of my argument, and we began to set the wheels in motion to bring the VICAP program under the aegis of the FBI as part of the NCAVC. When the new and larger grant was obtained, Brooks would come to Quantico to manage the program during its first year. With those concepts in mind, Brooks and the FBI applied for a grant of millions of dollars to begin the VICAP and NCAVC programs. My reasons for being so interested in VICAP were rooted in the work I had been doing for the FBI during the previous decade. In too many cases, police who were confronted with stranger murders did not act on them in the most optimal way in the early stages. David Berkowitz had killed several people before the New York City police began to acknowledge that there was any connection among the victims or the crimes. If VICAP had been in full operation, the connection would have been made sooner, and the arrest might have taken place in time to prevent the later murders. Similarly, during Wayne Williams's series of killings in Atlanta, for over a year the police denied that they had a serial killer's work on their hands. VICAP was needed to help the police in those cases, and VICAP was needed to tie into the NCAVC and other existing government programs, such as those dealing with missing persons, for another very good reason: to release people such as the parents of Johnny Gosch from their agony. One can get over a death, even the death of a child, but the uncertainty of not knowing anything keeps wounds open and hurting. 10 years after the abduction of their son, the Goshes would like to know whether he's dead or alive, whether his remains have ever been found, whether his killer has ever been caught and incarcerated, perhaps for a different crime. They need to put the matter to rest, and to do so they need information. VICAP and the NCAVC could help to provide the information that would make them rest easier. The establishment of VICAP and the NCAVC was no exception to the rule that making institutional change takes a while. Discussions on VICAP continued for a year. During one of our sessions in Texas, a member of the VICAP task force, a former reporter, burst into the room bearing the news that a man named Henry Lee Lucas had confessed to over 100 killings in nearly every state in the Union. "Here," said the former reporter, "was a perfect case on which to hang the need for VICAP." Those of us with more direct experience in homicide investigations looked more askance at the Lucas case, even though we did agree that its very existence might be helpful in convincing the public of the need for VICAP. Henry Lee Lucas was a one-eyed drifter in his late 40s when he was convicted of killing an elderly woman in a small town in Texas in 1983. At the time of his sentencing, Lucas told the judge that, although the authorities had nailed him on this charge, it was no big deal, because, since getting out of jail in 1975, he had been sent there for the murder of his mother, he'd killed hundreds of other people across the nation, some by himself and some in conjunction with another drifter, Otis Toole, whom he first met in 1979. That admission, and his later detailed confessions, kept Lucas off death row and sent law enforcement people throughout the country into a remarkable frenzy that lasted several years. The first people that Lucas roped in were the Texas Rangers. There were lots of inquiries coming to Texas from police and sheriff's departments in many states, seeking to find out whether Lucas had had anything to do with some of the unsolved murder cases they still had on their books. The Rangers quietly let it be known that if you had such an unsolved case in your jurisdiction and would send the particulars to them, they'd begin an inquiry and advise you whether you ought to come to Texas and put your questions directly to Lucas. Let's say your police department in southern Illinois had an unsolved homicide, a young woman raped and knifed to death behind a convenience store, and the signs seemed to point to the murderer having been a transient. You sent the case jacket to the Rangers, and they took up the matter with the prisoner. Instead of asking indirect questions to learn whether Lucas had been in Illinois on the dates in question, or whether he'd ever killed anyone near a convenience store, the Rangers asked especially leading questions of Lucas, questions that gave him the race, sex, and age of the victim, and sometimes even showed him the crime scene photographs to jog his memory, and then asked him whether he had committed the murder. Lucas was shrewd enough to say no to more than half the cases, but he also said yes to a large percentage. And when he said yes, a representative from that police department would go to Texas to interview Lucas personally, and then, often as not, would arrange for Lucas to take a trip to the state in which the murder had occurred, to visit the crime scene, testify in a trial, and so on. Almost always there was no other evidence and no witnesses on which to base a conviction for that crime. Incredibly, police from 35 states used this process to close the books on 210 unsolved murders. In the process, of course, Henry Lee Lucas got to leave his non-air-conditioned cell in Texas for large periods of time. On his excursions, he was conveyed to distant locations by airplane or car, stayed in motels, ate well in restaurants, and was generally treated as a celebrity. At one point early in the game, a sort of convention was held in which police officers from all over the country went to a central location to discuss the Lucas cases. I didn't attend, but I was told that this was the pinnacle of chaos. Observers likened the atmosphere to the pit of a commodities market, with everyone yelling and screaming and making hand gestures to try to claim certain cases as their own. My impression is that this fiasco was fueled not only by the need of police departments to close their difficult unsolved murder cases, but also by the boredom of local policemen, many of whom convinced their superiors that it was important for them to go to Texas on a sort of paid holiday in order to join the queue waiting to get in to interview Lucas. One of my superiors wanted to get in on the action and go to Texas to interview Lucas, not really to obtain information, but just to be able to say he'd been there and interviewed such a heinous criminal. Since I controlled the purse strings of the CPRP grant on which he wanted to travel, I was able to veto that idea. One agent from our Houston office did interview Lucas and asked him whether he had committed the murders in Guyana. "Yep," Lucas said. The agent asked him how he had gotten to Guyana. "Drove my car," Lucas responded. Questioned further, Lucas said he wasn't certain of the exact location of Guyana, but thought it was Louisiana or Texas. In short, he freely admitted that he had been responsible for the many hundreds of people who had died at the hands of Jim Jones in the Jonestown murder-suicides, several thousand miles away from the continental United States, when he obviously had had nothing to do with them. This was a clear indication that his confessions about the hundreds of other murders were just as false. Eventually, records of Lucas's employment in the mushroom fields of Pennsylvania, sales of scrap metal in Florida, credit card receipts, and other evidence were compared and tallied, and the discrepancies in his stories were made manifest. Some of the most important work in this regard was conducted by Hugh Ainsworth and Jim Henderson of the Dallas Times-Herald. Such diligent spade work established that, for instance, Lucas had physically been in Florida when a murder to which he later admitted was being committed in Texas. By the time I interviewed Lucas, years after the controversy had died down, the dust had settled, and Lucas said that he had actually committed none of the murders to which he had previously confessed. Under closer questioning, he did admit that since 1975 he had killed a few, fewer than 10, perhaps 5. He just wasn't sure. He had told all those lies in order to have fun, and to show up what he termed the stupidity of the police. It took several years for the Lucas fiasco to be resolved. The task force member had been right, though. If we had had VICAP up and running at the time Lucas made his first startling admission, it would have been easy to see what was truth and what was falsehood in his confession. First, we would have asked the police departments to fill out VICAP forms on their unsolved murders and enter them into the computer system. Then we would have analyzed them by date, location, and MO, and would quickly have been able to show that several of them had been committed on the same date in widely separated locations, thus eliminating the possibility that they were committed by the same man. By such processes of elimination, we would have narrowed the field very quickly and allowed investigators to concentrate on the real possibilities. While we were still developing the prototype VICAP form, the police in Los Angeles were in the midst of a major case that they called the Night Stalker. They weren't completely sure, but thought that a single person was responsible for a series of killings in the Hispanic areas of that city. We sent out some people from the emerging VICAP unit to give them technical assistance, primarily to help determine which victims could be attributed to the single killer and which could not. Most of that was fairly obvious to experienced investigators such as Frank Salerno of the LAPD, who had earlier been the point man on the Hillside Strangler case and who was in charge of the Night Stalker operation. But we were testing our form and also trying to be helpful without inserting ourselves into the limelight of the investigation. The goal was to show the police that they could use the FBI as a resource without running the risk of being upstaged. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, was caught with very little assistance from the FBI, but the case did help us to revise our form, which was initially too lengthy and tried to accomplish too much, as often happens when a project is put together by a committee. Later, we made the form shorter, though it is still quite detailed and takes about an hour for a policeman to fill out. The mid-1980s, when we were gearing up to ask for funding for VICAP and the NCAVC, coincided with a period that Philip Jenkins of Pennsylvania State University has called the Serial Killer Panic of 1983 to 1985. An article by Jenkins in the Criminal Justice Research Bulletin, 1988, cited numerous stories in newspapers and magazines during that period, all making the point that there were lots more unsolved murders in the United States than there had ever been before, that a large number of these were serial murders, and that new criminal justice system elements were needed to attack the growing problem. Jenkins cited the Lucas case as evidence that such matters were blown out of proportion. As I've reported earlier in this chapter, the trend certainly did show more and more unsolved stranger murders in the 1970s and 1980s than in early decades, but Jenkins was basically correct in his thesis. There was somewhat of a media feeding frenzy, if not a panic, over this issue in the mid-1980s, and we at the FBI and other people involved in urging the formation of VICAP did add to the general impression that there was a big problem, and that something needed to be done about it. We didn't exactly go out seeking publicity, but when a reporter called and we had a choice whether or not to cooperate on a story about violent crime, we gave the reporter good copy. In feeding the frenzy, we were using an old tactic in Washington, playing up the problem as a way of getting Congress and the higher-ups in the executive branch to pay attention to it. The difficulty was that some people in the bureaucracy went too far in their quest for attention. Pierce Brooks and I had urged the formation of NCAVC and VICAP on good grounds, but in our minds, these were long-term projects that might not pay off right away, at least not insofar as capturing criminals at the first touch of a computer terminal button. I recall saying to Pierce that if VICAP began officially in 1985, it would not be fully operational until 1995. My reasons for this prediction were simple to understand. Filling out VICAP forms and sending them into Quantico would be a voluntary procedure on the part of local police departments. It would take time to make those departments recognize the advantage to be gained by filling out and sending in the forms. And it would also take time to build a sufficient database and to perfect a system able to retrieve the information in a way that would be helpful in solving crimes. President Ronald Reagan announced the formation of the NCAVC at the annual convention of the National Sheriffs Association in Hartford, Connecticut, on June 21, 1984. He said that its primary mission was the identification and tracking of repeat killers. Pilot funds were provided by the National Institutes of Justice. Pierce Brooks came on board, spent 9 months with us, and at the end of May 1985, sat down at a terminal at Quantico and watched as we entered data from the first real incoming VICAP form into the computer. It had taken 27 years, but his dream of a way to match data from one violent crime to another had finally taken operational form. 3 days later, Pierce was on his way back to Oregon, and the program was turned over to me to manage. I didn't want it. VICAP is a number cruncher's dream, and I'm more interested in behavioral sciences and in active ongoing investigations. The best man for the job was a Department of Justice supervisor, Robert O. Heck, who had shepherded the large grant through the bureaucratic mills, had done a tremendous amount of work on the project, and had expected to run the program after it was fully established. Higher-ups in the FBI had even promised that job to him. Once the FBI obtained the grant money, however, the management told Heck that they were going to administer it, not him. Heck was bitter, and so was I. Nonetheless, things kept rolling onward. In October of 1985, the entire cost of funding the NCAVC was absorbed into the regular annual budget of the FBI. Its four basic programs were research and development, mostly consisting of my criminal personality research project, training of field agents and local police, profiling, and VICAP. Another monkey wrench was soon thrown into the works. The original plan for VICAP called for one manager and many junior analysts to do the actual work of taking the data from the incoming forms and entering it into the computer, and others who would actively cajole local police departments into using the forms for their unsolved homicides and other violent crimes. During the first year of appropriations, the money for those subordinate jobs was channeled by my superiors into the purchase of computer equipment. So we had some shiny new electronic playthings and no one to do the drab, time-consuming work of entering information into the system. In subsequent appropriations, my superiors decided that rather than use the money earmarked for data enterers and junior analysts, they would instead hire high-level managers and senior crime analysts who had very little to analyze because very little data was being punched into the system. It had been naively predicted that all the unsolved cases would go into the computer in the first year. Since there were about 5,000 unsolved murders a year, that would have meant that by 1989, after 4 years of operation, there ought to have been 20,000 cases in the computer's memory. By that time, only 5,000 had been entered, and the program appeared to fail to live up to its potential. Only in the late 1980s, near to the time of my retirement from the Bureau, were we able to hire the appropriate mid-level technicians to get data put in, and, simultaneously, to convince enough local police departments to send us their completed forms so that VICAP would begin to have a chance to show what it could do. There are still several major cities and states that won't fully participate in the VICAP program, and their refusal to participate means the system has a somewhat lower chance of accomplishing the goals set for it. I believe that the federal government should mandate local departments to report their unsolved violent crimes to VICAP, as they are required to do for the Uniform Crime Reporting System. If this was done, and such VICAP reporting was standard procedure in all police departments, I am certain that we could reduce the 25% of all unsolved homicides to between 5 and 10%. Here's my reasoning. VICAP doesn't all have to do with serial murderers, who would be traced because, for example, we are able to match the pattern of knife wounds on victim A in Massachusetts to those on victim B in New Hampshire, giving police more of a lead on the killer. A lot of other crimes would feed into it. For instance, say that you had a single homicide by gun in New Jersey. The bullet was found, but not the killer. The information was entered into the VICAP computer, though. say that 2 years later, in a bar in Texas, a man was arrested for an attempted rape and a gun was seized from him. Running that gun's ballistic particulars through the VICAP computer might turn up a match, and the man arrested in Texas could be tied to the unsolved single homicide in New Jersey. We're not at that point yet, but we will be, and we need to be. As I write this in the late summer of 1991, the need for a strong VICAP is more apparent than ever. Just recently, after admitting to the killing of one 10-year-old girl, Donald Leroy Evans in Gulfport, Louisiana, startled his captors and the nation by saying that he has killed more than 60 people in 20 states since 1977. Two of the murders have now been verified, so Evans may in fact be a serial killer of serious proportions. That is not certain, however, and the whole affair could turn into a chaotic mess of the sort that surrounded the Henry Lee Lucas confession in the early 1980s, unless the crimes are examined in some detail. The best way to do that would be to enter the details of every crime to which Evans confesses into the VICAP computer, cross-check them against the FBI's missing persons and unidentified dead programs, and analyze them against his travel patterns and other particulars, so the truth of his serial killer claims can be evaluated. Using all those systems is now possible, though they are not yet interlinked. Even though certain cities and states in this country have not wanted to work with VICAP, England, Australia, New Zealand, Korea, and other countries have shown great interest in the program. Since my retirement, I have conducted seminars in some of these countries about VICAP and criminal profiling. They are eager to join forces and submit data in the hope of more quickly apprehending violent criminals. My original estimate that VICAP would be fully operational by 1995 seems, in hindsight, like a pretty good guess after all, though I certainly took a lot of heat in the FBI for having said so in 1985. 11. Two for the show. On June 20th, 1988, I was the master of ceremonies for an unusual live, closed-circuit video show featuring two of the country's most notorious and dangerous serial murderers. The occasion was an attempt to get the VICAP program more widely accepted. In the service of that objective, we were holding the first-ever International Homicide Symposium at Quantico. In attendance were 300 law enforcement officials from the United States and abroad. Our focus was to try and standardize the procedures for investigating homicides from country to country. Each country, indeed, in the United States, each separate jurisdiction, seems to go about the business of examining a crime scene, questioning witnesses, and hunting killers in a different way. As program manager of VICAP, I wanted to make people aware of our national program for the apprehension of violent criminals. Bringing them to Washington, D.C. was the first part of the Bureau's plan. Giving our guests an experience they would probably never have elsewhere, something to talk about when they got home, was the second part. And that unique experience was going to be provided by live interviews of two notorious serial killers. Because of my extensive interviewing of both men, done over a period of nearly 10 years each, I was able to persuade John Wayne Gacy and Edmund Kemper to visit with us from their prisons in Illinois and California. Both men trusted me, and, I believe, would not have consented to these unique interviews had I not been in charge of the proceedings and made the request personally. After I had made the preliminary arrangements, a Bureau paper shuffler tried to horn in on the glory and wanted to act as the master of ceremonies. I told him that if Gacy or Kemper heard his voice when he expected to hear mine, he might just refuse to go on with the show and we'd all have egg on our faces. The paper shuffler decided that he'd have to settle for some brief introductory remarks and then sat down and behaved as a good audience member should, leaving the performance to me. The idea of interviewing a convicted murderer by satellite had earlier been broached to me by staff members of the Geraldo Rivera television program, but I refused to get involved in asking anyone to appear on commercial television, believing that this was not a proper thing for a Bureau employee to do. The Rivera program had tried to convince the California prison system to let Charles Manson appear live, but had been unable to do so. Rather, the prison had allowed the program to come and do its own extensive taped interview with Manson. Later, this had been broadcast in several parts, during which Dr. Jack Levin of Northeastern University and I were asked to critique what Manson had said. Our closed-circuit program, by contrast, was interactive. The two men faced video cameras, whose images were sent to Quantico via satellite and projected on very large screens. I first presented their cases in slide lectures to our audience, then acted as a funnel for the audience's questions to them. We could see them, but they could only hear us. Each man answered questions for a period of 90 minutes, and it was quite a show, for Gacy and Kemper are both extremely intelligent and articulate, in addition to being dangerous serial murderers. I had been driving to Chicago with my family in late 1978 for a Christmas vacation when I heard on the radio that bodies were being discovered on the grounds of a small house near Des Plaines, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago not far from O'Hare Airfield and not far from where I had grown up. Several bodies had been discovered, and the radio report said there might be many more to come. For a man interested in multiple murder, this was too important an opportunity to pass by, vacation or not. Depositing my family at our relative's home, I said a few words of greeting and apology, and then grabbed my camera and took off for the crime scene. There were dozens of people swarming around, many of them families looking for hints of vanished relatives. I asked the local FBI agent for help, and he introduced me to the man in charge of the burgeoning investigation, Joe Kozinsak, former chief of the Des Plaines Police Department. By this time, the search and exhumation of the bodies had been taken over by the Cook County Sheriff's Office, and I met those investigators as well. By chance, Howard Vanek, a lieutenant in that office, had been in my class at Quantico, and so I quickly became acquainted with the case at the time it was breaking. Here's how it had begun. December 11, 1978, was Elizabeth Peast's birthday, and she was waiting for her 15-year-old son, Robert Peast, to finish up work at a drugstore in Des Plaines so she could drive him home for the family party. Robert told his mother he had to go out to the parking lot to see a contractor about a summer construction job, one that would pay him nearly twice as much as he was currently making at the drugstore. 10 minutes later, when Bob didn't come back for her, Mrs. Peast became alarmed, went home, and called the police. They told her that adolescent boys often don't come home when they're supposed to, and advised her to stay calm. By 11:30 that night, Mrs. Peast could wait no longer, and she insisted to the police that they start to search for her son. About 20,000 people a year are reported missing in the Chicago area, and probably 19-plus thousand of them are found within a few hours to a year. So police are often reluctant to search seriously for missing people before allowing more time to elapse than had occurred in this case. But Chief of Detectives Joe Kozinsak determined to institute a real search. He, too, had a 15-year-old son in the same school as Mrs. Peast, and knew the Peast boy as an all-American kid, a gymnast. This was not the sort of boy to vanish and not call home. It seemed certain that something had gone wrong. Interviewing people at the drugstore, Kozinsak learned that a local contractor, John Wayne Gacy, had been in the store on December 11th, doing a remodeling estimate during which he had taken pictures of the place and written down measurements. Kozinsak had already begun looking for previous conviction records on Gacy, but none turned up by the morning of the 13th, when Gacy walked in the door of the police station in response to a call to come in to discuss the matter. Gacy was 36, a short, pudgy man with a double chin and a dark mustache. To outward appearances, he was an upstanding and civic-minded businessman, a contractor who also did interior design and maintenance work. He had been involved in local politics, had even led a Polish Constitution Day parade that featured Rosalind Carter, and had had his photograph taken with the First Lady, and had dressed up as a clown in full makeup to entertain children at charitable events. He had lived in the same house since 1972 and was well known in the community. To Kozinsack, Gacy denied knowing Robert Peast or having any contact with him. Joe told Gacy that he had been seen in the parking lot with the boy, and Gacy changed his story slightly to cover the possibility that he might have been seen in contiguity with him in the parking lot, but no further. Kozinsack told me later that he had had an intuitive feeling that Gacy was lying. The way Gacy made denials was too pat and not completely convincing. Kozinsack's men obtained a search warrant and looked into Gacy's house in a very cursory way. They found some young men's clothing and a receipt for a roll of film then being developed at the pharmacy in Des Plaines where Peast worked, a receipt not in Gacy's name. The investigation revealed that Peast had loaned his jacket to a girl who also worked in the store. She had turned in a roll of film for developing and had mistakenly left the receipt in the pocket of the jacket when she returned the jacket to Peast. Kozinsack and his superiors felt they did not have enough information yet on which to arrest Gacy for anything. Officially, Robert Peast was still missing, but they did have enough to put Gacy under complete and open surveillance and to question his friends, associates, and acquaintances. This was a tight surveillance. The men were on the street with him, and when he was in his car, the watchers sometimes came close to locking bumpers with him, trying to provoke him into some action. Gacy was calm at first. He told the tailors that their stupid superiors had put them up to this, and that he didn't hold them personally responsible. He'd tell them where his next destination was, in case they lost him in traffic, and at least once offered to buy them lunch at the diner toward which he was heading. In 5 days under the surveillance, his behavior crumbled to the point that he stopped shaving and started drinking and using drugs and shouting at people. This did not stop him from stringing Christmas lights on the outside of his home, as had been his custom at earlier holiday seasons. Gacy found two lawyers and asked them to institute a suit against the police for harassment, alleging that the surveillance was preventing him from doing business. The day after the lawsuit was begun, December 20th, Kozinsack finally received the paperwork that told him Gacy had been convicted of sodomy with an adolescent boy in Iowa in 1968. Gacy had spent several years in prison for that offense, and had been such a model prisoner that he even started a prison branch of the J.C.'s. The sentence had been for 10 years, but Gacy's sterling behavior won him parole in 1970. After being released, Gacy had moved to Illinois, and there had been a charge against him of aggravated battery and reckless conduct in mid-1972. A young man claimed Gacy had picked him up in a homosexual district, then had taken him home, and had attempted to hurt him. A few days after Gacy's arrest, Gacy told police that this young man was attempting to extort money from him in exchange for dropping the charges, and he wanted the young man arrested for that. Nothing came of either charge. When the young man did not show up in court to press the matter of the abduction, charges against Gacy were dismissed. Armed with this new information, Kozinsack decided he had enough grounds to ask for a full search warrant, obtained one, and together with the Cook County Sheriff's Office, arrived at Gacy's residence on December 21st with his men in force, and began a thorough search of the house. Gacy was there, and the detectives accused him of holding Robert Peast in the house. Gacy denied it, but did say that back in 1972 he had been forced to kill one of his homosexual partners in self-defense, and that he had buried the body beneath the concrete floor of his garage. As the police watched, Gacy took a can of paint and spray-painted the place on the concrete floor where he said the body still lay. Inside the house, the police later found a trapdoor to a crawl space, crawled inside, and found three decomposing bodies and parts of others. Gacy was arrested and charged with murder. In his initial confession, witnessed by a half dozen detectives, he confessed to the murder of Robert Peast and to that of 27 other young males, most of whose bodies, he said, were buried beneath the house, and the last few of which, including Peast, he had tossed into the Des Plaines River. Police went to work on Gacy's home and grounds so thoroughly that when they were finished, all that was left standing were the outside walls, roof, and support beams. They were looking, the Cook County medical examiner told reporters, for any scrap of evidence, a ring, a belt buckle, a button, that will help us to identify the victims. That was because Gacy couldn't remember more than a few of the victims' names. By the time the body count was complete, there were 33 victims, 29 in and under the house, 4 in the river, more than had died at the hands of any other single individual in the history of American crime. Most of the dead were young males between the ages of 15 and 20. Ted Bundy might have killed more people, but not all of their bodies were ever found or attributed directly to him. John Gacy was officially the worst killer in modern times. Gacy initially confessed to the murders in some detail, then, on the advice of counsel, said no more. The killings, Gacy had admitted, began one night in January 1972. He had trolled the Greyhound bus station near Chicago's Loop for sex partners, and brought home a young man and had sex with him. According to Gacy, the next morning, he saw that young man coming at him with a knife, struggled with him, and managed to stab his attacker in the chest. He buried this young man in the crawl space. Later in 1972, Gacy married for the second time. His first marriage, which produced two children, ended in divorce during his earlier prison term. The second wife asked him about the wallets of young men that Gacy had in the house, but he shouted at her that this was none of her business, and she put them out of mind. Then she complained of strange odors in the home, and while she was away on vacation, Gacy later said, he poured concrete over that first body to conceal the smell. Gacy's mother-in-law and the wife's children from a previous marriage lived with the couple during the next few years, during which, according to the mother-in-law, the odor of dead rats continued. So did the murders. Gacy couldn't remember precisely when he'd killed for the second time, but he remembered it as between 1972 and 1975, and forensic evidence later corroborated this date. He strangled a young man, then placed him in a bedroom closet for storage before burial, and became a bit distressed that bodily fluids leaked out of the victim's mouth and stained a carpet. Subsequently, he told authorities, he learned to stuff cloths or other materials in his victim's mouths to prevent any telltale leaks. According to that first confession, in mid-1975, John Butkovich, a 20-year-old construction employee of Gacy's, came to the house with some friends and demanded back wages owed to him. After an unresolved argument, Butkovich left. Later that night, Gacy was cruising in his car and picked up Butkovich. He took the young man back to the house and offered him drinks. Then he said he'd show him a handcuff trick. Handcuffed, Butkovich was helpless, and he sputtered at Gacy that if he ever got out, he'd kill him. In response, Gacy showed Butkovich his second deadly amusement, the rope trick, in which Gacy placed a noose around the young man's neck, stuck a stick in it, and tightened it slowly, strangling him. Gacy's handcuff and rope tricks were later described by several young men who had been picked up by Gacy and taken to his home, but had refused to participate in those magic demonstrations, and so had survived. Butkovich did not, and was buried in a trench at the end of a tool shed near the garage, and also covered with concrete. The Butkovich family suspected Gacy at the time, but police did not follow up on their suspicions. "If the police had only paid attention to us, they might have saved many lives," Butkovich's father later told reporters. The police didn't follow up, most likely because they thought that Butkovich, like thousands of other young men around the country, had simply run away from home. Moreover, to have uncovered the crime, they would have had to have some tangible evidence even to ask a judge for a search warrant of Gacy's home, and they had none. Later, more was learned about Gacy's techniques for luring and controlling his victims, and about his sadistic acts. He usually cruised the homosexual districts for victims, many of whom were transients who would not be missed for some time. On other occasions, he struck close to home, convincing some part-time employees to come to his residence on the promise of paying back wages. Once there, they would be plied with liquor and drugs, and then he would offer to show them movies. He'd begin with heterosexual pornography, then introduce some homosexual films. Then, if the young man did not object too strenuously, he'd bring out the handcuff and rope tricks. When a victim was immobilized, Gacy would sexually assault him. Afterward, Gacy would often put him in a bathtub, sometimes with a plastic bag over his head, and nearly drown him, then revive him in order to inflict more sexual assaults and torture. Gacy was a smart man with a high IQ, but more important, he was a highly manipulative man with good verbal skills, able to diffuse a victim's paranoia and curiosity about himself. He was a spider who had to get victims into the very center of the web before being able to kill them. Whereas Ted Bundy would hit women in the face with a crowbar, Gacy used neither guns nor knives nor blunt instruments, but immobilized his victims through trickery and deceit. The more he got away with the abductions, assaults, and murders, the more elaborate the rituals and the torture became. With a high opinion of himself, and a low one of the police and everyone else, Gacy transformed himself into a practiced and expert killer. In February of 1976, Gacy's second wife and her family moved out, and his killings began to escalate at a rate of approximately one a month. As he went on, Gacy must have come to believe that he was invincible, for he was not even suspected in the murders. He became more bold and cavalier, not resorting to the anonymity of the homosexual district, but taking young men right off the street. One who had been on the way home from a horseback riding stable, others from his cadre of part-time employees. Young males between the ages of about 15 and 20 simply disappeared, and most of the time it was believed they had simply become runaways. While the killings continued, so did Gacy's success in the local and business communities. He became a block captain, toured the children's wards and hospitals in his homemade clown outfit, and threw an annual block party for 400 neighbors. He was always available for any chore, washing windows, setting up chairs for meetings, even fixing someone's leaky faucet, a local Democratic Party official told reporters, and concluded, "I don't know anyone who didn't like him." Early stories in the newspapers stressed the idea that Gacy was a Jekyll and Hyde character. As I have argued in other chapters of this book, the Jekyll and Hyde story is simply not the right explanation for this sort of murderer. The deadly side is always there, but the murderer is frequently successful in hiding it from the outside world. When Gacy was traced back in time, it was possible to see that the strange murderous side of him had been in evidence for 15 years. Back in the 1960s, in Iowa, when he managed three fried chicken franchise restaurants for his first father-in-law, he would use his position to lure young male employees into having sex with him. In an official statement of facts submitted by the state's attorney of Cook County, it is alleged that young men would be rewarded with sex with Gacy's first wife in return for oral sex with Gacy. Moreover, when a sodomy victim reported him to the authorities, Gacy hired another young man to beat him up and convince him not to testify. It was only after one well-connected victim complained that Gacy was charged with sodomy, convicted, and sent to jail. Class rings, car title papers, and other possessions of the dead victims were found in Gacy's home. In one case, Gacy had sold a dead victim's car to an employee. In fact, he had kept a trophy from almost every victim. By early 1978, Gacy considered the crawl space and other caches on his property to be too full of bodies to contain any more, and he began dumping victims off bridges into the Des Plaines River. When Kozinsak and his investigators questioned Gacy in his home on December 12, 1978, the body of Robert Peast was still in the attic. Somehow, before the intense phase of the police surveillance began, Gacy managed to sneak the body out of the house and throw it, too, into the river. It was not even found until after Gacy's trial. By that point, only about half of the victims had been positively identified. At the trial, Gacy's attorneys argued that he suffered from having multiple personalities, that Jack Handley had done the murders. Gacy suggested that his Jack and John personalities were opposites. The actual Jack Handley had been a police officer in the Chicago area whose name Gacy had appropriated. Still later, Gacy argued that because of the nature of his business, at least a dozen men had keys to his home, and some of his associates lived there from time to time and could also have been involved in murders. He revised his own story to say that he had killed only a handful, not 33, and to say that he certainly had not killed every young man with whom he had sex. Some of these theories began to surface in 60 hours of audio tapes that Gacy recorded for use by his attorneys at the trial, tapes in which Gacy also admitted to many of the murders. The state pursued a case solely against Gacy, ignoring some evidence that there might indeed have been other people involved. Two associates of Gacy's, who did spend time at his home. This is something that often happens in big cases. The DA pursues the one very good suspect and doesn't develop the others because that would complicate an otherwise straightforward prosecution. The important thing seems to be to handle the case expeditiously, and so the prosecution can be successful in obtaining a verdict against an obviously guilty man. At the trial, Gacy and his attorneys presented a defense of him as not guilty by reason of insanity. The prosecution countered by demonstrating that the steps Gacy took to procure victims, to render them immobile, to kill them, and then consciously after death to conceal their bodies, argued that Gacy's crimes were premeditated murders, and that he clearly knew the difference between right and wrong at the time of the crimes. After nearly 6 weeks of trial, the jury pronounced him guilty of the murder of the 33 victims, and Gacy was sentenced to die in the electric chair. After his conviction, I requested an audience with John Gacy, and he consented to see me, together with some associates from the BSU. Gacy claimed to know me from his childhood. Our homes were 4 blocks from one another, and he remembered delivering groceries to my mother's house, even describing some unusual flower pots that were part of the landscaping. So we talked about the neighborhood and developed a relationship of sorts. I had learned enough about conversing with murderers so that I was able to approach Gacy on a rather objective basis, without stigmatizing him for what he had done. By this time, Gacy had become convinced that the police, the psychiatrists, and the courts were all full of fools who simply did not understand him and were beneath him intellectually, but that I was schooled in the ways of intelligent killers and could talk to him about his life in a reasonable way. Gacy states that 2 or 3 of his former employees were involved in the crimes. As part of my interchange with Gacy, I told him that I agreed that the police should have more vigorously pursued those employees who had stayed in the Gacy house from time to time. I was sincere in that belief, and still feel today that there are unexplored avenues that might be traced and might reveal others who were involved in the murders. Gacy would not speak directly to the media and even refused monetary offers for interviews. He said he wanted to tell his story one day, and I urged him to do so. However, I cautioned that he'd have to be candid and not claim he hadn't killed all of the victims. In fact, I told him, I thought he might have killed more than 33 since he had traveled widely. In 14 states, he could have trawled homosexual transient districts for victims elsewhere. Gacy neither admitted nor denied my accusation. Through the years, I continued to stay in touch with Gacy. In our later conversations, he devalued the young men he had killed as worthless little queers and punks. I challenged him about that. Why was he running down his victims? If they were worthless homosexuals, what was he? Gacy's answer was that they were useless runaways, while he was a successful and busy businessman who didn't have many hours available for dating. He told me that he found it more satisfactory to have quick sex with a young man than to wine and dine and romance a woman, which took too much time from his very full schedule. This didn't sit well with me, but I simply accepted his comment without question at the time in order to maintain our rapport. Gacy later made a painting and sent it to me. It depicts a clown, dressed in a similar outfit to the one that Gacy had used, posing in the midst of a grove of evergreen trees, surrounded by balloons. The inscription read, "You cannot hope to enjoy the harvest without first laboring in the fields." Some people take this as a compliment to me, with the meaning that I was able to get close to Gacy because I had spent so much time working with multiple murderers and so had been properly prepared to talk to him. On the other hand, some people interpret the inscription to mean that there are even more Gacy victims who have not yet been found. Gacy himself refuses to explicate. People who become notorious through crime often attract outsiders to them. That's what happened to John Gacy in prison in 1986. A twice-divorced woman with 8 children came to visit him, and they started an extended correspondence. 2 years and 41 letters later, the woman was persuaded to let the Chicago Sun-Times publish excerpts from some of the letters. They contained such passages as the following. "I'm a gullible person, and I think you are too, but you can overcome it. And it has nothing to do with educational background. I hold 3 college degrees. Big deal. It doesn't mean a thing without common sense. Streetwise people you can learn from, but you've got to be on guard for the con, too. I mean, what the," deleted, "the state said I was manipulative or a manipulator. Hell yes. But had I not been, I would not have been successful. You wouldn't be successful undercover if you didn't manipulate at times." Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Marvin Zaporin, who had been the chief psychiatrist at the prison where Gacy was incarcerated, evaluated the letters for the newspaper and wrote an analysis of them. Zaporin had also interviewed Richard Speck in depth and had written a book about Speck, Born to Raise Hell. Zaporin wrote that in every letter, almost in every paragraph, Gacy displayed the 2 major themes of his thinking. The first was that Gacy's view of himself was as a nice guy, which Zaporin said meant heterosexual. Helpful, friendly, generous, loving, virile, and courageous. Simultaneously, Zaporin wrote, Gacy was at pains to deny that there was a bad me. Bad being weak, timorous, cowardly, and, above all else, homosexual. That bad me had committed the murders. His denial of the bad me allowed the belief in himself as fundamentally good. Here, wrote Zaporin, was a classic sociopath, a man whose huge ego exists solely to satisfy his own appetite for existence. His answer to the question, "What is one allowed to do?" is, "Whatever one can get away with." His answer to the question, "What is good?" is, "Whatever is good for me." Even in the letters, Gacy was trying to control his new friend, telling her, says Zaporin, what to do, what to think, how to deal with her family, how to manage her affairs. And it was in this display that one could see Gacy's need to control and dominate, the dynamic that led to his involvement in bondage and murder. In later years, Gacy has come to believe that his troubles are traceable to his early childhood. Born of immigrant parents, Polish and Danish, He grew up in a household where discipline was strict, and his father drank and often bullied family members. He claimed to have been molested at the age of 5 by a teenaged girl and at the age of 8 by a male contractor. By the age of 10, he was having epileptic seizures, and his medical conditions kept him out of sports and other activities in high school. When he began to work,